I'm on. Okay. Now, back to Hindenburg, Hitler, and the Constitution and all that. What the Nazis did was to declare, under the Weimar Constitution, a state of emergency. When Hitler was elected, he gave a plebiscite, I guess, after Hindenburg died. He said that that will be the last election in Germany for 1,000 years. But he said that with perfect constitutionality, because the Constitution, the Weimar Constitution, allowed him to declare a state of emergency. It had no limits on it. Now, when people say the U.S. Constitution, well, Hitler's logic on this was that the Weimar Constitution was out of date. It was old-fashioned. Yeah, I got your message, Kelso. Thank you. And so it needed to be interpreted. He interpreted it. He said, we now have a permanent state of emergency. This was perfectly constitutional if you believe that a constitution, if what is written is interpreted, then you have a living constitution, which means that what was originally written down, what the founding fathers originally said, was nice, but it needs to be constantly updated by the Supreme Court. Now, there's another word for a living constitution. It's called a dictatorship. If someone becomes, because if you interpret the Constitution, you are the Constitution. The Constitution is not a piece of paper, it's what's enforced. So, if you allow anybody to, quote, interpret, unquote, the Constitution, then that person is the Constitution. And a gentleman named Adolf Hitler proved it. And officially, when Germany surrendered, they were still under the Weimar Constitution, the Weimar Republic. The name Deutsches Reich, it was the name that was not a name Hitler put on it. It was the name of Germany after World War II as well as before. So, if you have a living constitution, what you have is a dictatorship. A living constitution is a dictatorship. The constitution has... Now, the other thing is, there's the balance of powers and the separation of powers. If one branch of the government is the Constitution, then there's no balance between the branches. The group that is the Constitution, the 9 judges of the United States Supreme Court, and any local judge, federal judge, if you feel like it, is the living constitution, or, to use the exact same word, a dictator. I've seen this a lot with the busing decision. The court would appropriate money. It actually instituted taxes that it felt should be used for housing for the poor, i.e. the minorities. And in the New Right Papers, I pointed out that a government, that since the judicial opinion is law, I said a situation where one man's opinion is law has a name and is not democracy. Stalin was a very constitutional gentleman. He wrote up a constitution in 1936. It was much more liberal than ours. It guaranteed freedom of speech, freedom of this, freedom of that. It even guaranteed all the Soviet republics the right to secede. All Stalin did was interpret it. It's sort of like when somebody says, you can do anything you want to as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. A slave can do anything he wants to as long as it doesn't hurt anybody else. Because if a slave tries to be free, then he is hurting his master, who paid for him. That was the logic of the United States before 1860. So, again, that's kind of a silly idea. It's like you have freedom of speech as long as you don't offend anybody or hurt anybody's feelings. That's not freedom of speech. So I think we go back to the idea that a living constitution is a dictatorship. Whoever does the interpreting, nine men or one, become the set of dictators of the country. Very simple, very true, and I think it cuts to the heart of this constitution, this idea of living constitution. If the United States wants a living, a living constitution, which means that this group of people is now empowered to be the Constitution, then the American people are perfectly free to put that in a constitutional amendment. It's important to know who gave the Supreme Court the right to interpret the Constitution. It was the Supreme Court. In 1834, the last president with guts, I guess, named Andrew Jackson, when the Supreme Court made a decision, he said, "The Supreme Court has made its decision, now let them enforce it." In other words, he told the Supreme Court where to go, which is why you have different branches of government. And so Jackson, as he did so many other people, he was born in South Carolina, did what the balance of power is intended to do. That is, he interpreted the Constitution himself. Barry Goldwater, in fact, said that in his 1959 book, The Conscience of a Conservative. He said, it is up to all branches of government to interpret the Constitution. Now we're settling more and more for the idea that this is Supreme Court's job or the court's job to interpret the Constitution. When the president takes the oath to preserve and defend the Constitution of the United States, he is saying that he takes an oath to preserve and defend the latest opinion of the United States Supreme Court. Somebody described the Supreme Court as the permanent Constitutional Convention of the United States. One good example is when they decided in 1968, the Supreme Court struck down all aim assignation laws in America. Now there is no question whatsoever of original intent in that. In other words, there is no way that any of the founding fathers intended to prevent states from having anti miscegenation law. The reason I say that is because every single one of the 13 states had and enforced anti miscegenation laws. The 14th Amendment, which was the other basis, if you know, Constitution, but the 14th Amendment, I believe there were two states in the entire United States that allowed miscegenation. In this case, specifically the blacks, they had a lot of other laws, Indians and so forth, I guess, Chinese and California. But everybody that ratified nobody, and even in the one or two states that did not, that had struck down their anti-miscegenation laws recently, would ever have said they had no right to have a state anti-miscegenation law. All right, let's fast forward to the United States today. Now remember, that was a 1968 decision. It had no basis whatsoever in anything except the Supreme Court didn't like anti-miscegenation laws, so it struck them down. In that case, it's pure naked takeover. There's no question. Then, you fast forward to today, and all these people are desperately upset that the courts take it upon themselves to allow gay marriage. Why? Why are they upset? Back in 1968, the Catholic Church hierarchy And just about every northerner I knew was just delighted with the Supreme Court deciding to strike down all these laws. And one thing we said to them was, just wait, buddy. Well, in 1973, the Supreme Court came down with this decision to legalize abortion throughout America. And everybody acts like everything started then. Well, it didn't start then. Once the Supreme Court got away with that 1968 decision, now it had made a lot of other decisions that were totally had nothing to do with the Founding Fathers, but this one was open. This one was naked. They said, no matter what all these Founding Fathers said, the miscegenation laws are down and gone. Now, at that point, just exactly who, if they not only accepted but cheered that decision, who is going to have the chutzpah to object to the Supreme Court doing any damn thing it wants to? I mean, if it wants to say abortion is legal, if it wants to say that gay marriage is legal, why are you suddenly objecting to this? They have taken over completely. Anything they say is the Constitution. And the problem is, of course, that nobody dares to go back and say, because now interracial marriage is holy in America, nobody dares to go back and say, if you approve that 1968 decision, then all the rest of it follows. There is no limit on what the Supreme Court, especially in the case of marriage, they've already set the precedent. I'm absolutely, you know, I would be dumbfounded, but I know how stupid these people are. The respectable conservative would never dare talk about that 1968 decision. I mean, it's holy to them, because they wouldn't be respectable if it wasn't. But once you accept that, like everything else, we all know it. Once you approve of tyranny over one group of people, you're going to get tyranny over yourself. But the ACLU and all those groups just sort of pass that over. The Constitution is either a dictatorship or it is the opinion of a group of people. The fact that these people are 9 lawyers sitting around in black dresses makes no difference. And that's another problem. The whole idea that when someone, a lawyer, has political influence and he gets to get put on black robe, all of a sudden when he walks in the courtroom, he's your honor or your holiness or, you know, Lord Almighty or whatever it is I'd call him. And people take that seriously. The law, actually, in the real world, is as flawed as we are. People always worry themselves to death. Are you executing an innocent person? Well, let me break something to you. Every time a court lets a repeat felon back on the street, somebody's going to get hurt. Now, again, this is pure heresy, but that guy who gets killed tonight, there'll be at least, a dozen, maybe 100 people who will get killed by repeat criminals who were let right back on the street. And those people are all innocent. But we worry ourselves to death whether innocent people are going to be executed. Well, let me tell you for sure, innocent people are going to be executed. Now, then there are people who say, now I have never heard an argument against capital punishment that didn't apply just as well to every kind of punishment. I always say, will it deter? They have all these arguments and so forth, but try to find an argument against capital punishment that cannot be used against all punishment. The fact is, people are going to make mistakes, people are going to get hurt, but as far as the government is concerned, or this silly old statement, it's better to let 100 guilty people loose than to punish one innocent man. When you let those guilty people loose, you are killing innocent people. The ones out on the street they kill are all innocent. So this is a little nutsy. So what we've got is we're talking about a constitution, which is essentially a dictatorship. We're worrying ourselves to death about the people who are going to be punished. It's supposed to be much more moral, for example. Instead of putting somebody on the chair and electrocuting, what you gotta do is put them in a steel cage for the rest of their lives. Now, this seems to make a big difference to people, but I think being stuck in a steel cage is not an innocent thing if you make a mistake. The whole thing, if you think about it, now, what am I talking about? I'm talking about the untrained eye. I'm just looking at the world as it actually is. I don't have a trained eye. I don't believe that when a lawyer puts on a black dress, that he suddenly becomes something holy, or the Constitution of the United States. I used to make a joke. I say, well, if a guy puts on a black robe, a black dress, and he becomes the Constitution, if he puts on mascara and high heels, does he then become the Bible? Makes just as much sense. But I'm looking at all this from the point of view of the untrained eye. Let me run back over why I say that. I was talking about the Flat Earth Society in England, and I think they just enjoy themselves insisting that the Earth is flat. And so back in the 1960s, when the Supreme Court, the American ambassador got the pictures from NASA, we had our first satellites going around, he got the pictures from NASA. And so he called in, just for fun, the president of, in London, where it was, the president of the Flat Earth Society, and that gentleman, with his English imperturbability, was very grateful. He looked at the pictures, and he said, "It is amazing how, to the untrained eye, the earth looks round." Which, of course, is, you know, that's English. I thought of English humor at its best. But, again, if you look at a living constitution with a trained eye, you realize that these Supreme Court, these guys in dresses up there, the two girls in dresses too, black dresses in the Supreme Court, that they are judges. They're not just clowns like you and me. They are judges. And so they have this air of holiness about them. If you look at the world with the untrained eye, if a guy who's wearing a black dress suddenly becomes the Constitution, you got what you had in Germany in the 30s. The gentleman who decided that he was going to interpret the Weimar Constitution was a dictator. The only difference is he said so. But here, with a trained eye, you don't see that. With a trained eye, you could ignore the 1968 decision of the Supreme Court, which gave them absolute carte blanche. They could ignore everything about intent. And all these people, I mean, it was amazing, just the cheers, hosannas, and today, the cheers and hosannas that every respectful conservative has to make about Supreme Court knocking down any miscegenation laws, nobody dares question that. But the problem is, until you get to the cause of the disease, you can't cure it. All this blustering and screaming about whether Roe versus Wade was in the spirit of the Founding Fathers, or whether the Supreme Court deciding on gay marriage is not in the spirit of the Founding Fathers, you've got to be a real clown, if you know anything about constitutional law, too. And I took it in graduate school. I instructed it when the professor was out with a hangover or whatever. He would have me do it. But The fact is, again, now let's look at constitutional law. I opened a book here and I looked under Constitution, and it had this document in there. It's about 2 pages long. It's got amendments and all that stuff, and they had this under Constitution. Now you and I both know that's not the Constitution. When I was studying and teaching constitutional law, we didn't say the Constitution, the written thing. We studied decisions, Supreme Court decisions, district court decisions. In international law, we studied foreign decisions that were used by the United States. But we never studied that piece of paper that has long since been forgotten. It has absolutely nothing to do with any constitution. So like the Bible, you know, you can pick yourself out a piece of it and you can set up an inquisition on it if you want to. You say you're doing something biblical. Everybody who ever massacred people or burned them alive said they were doing it according to the Bible. You see, they were just interpreting it. So the untrained eye, again, in the case of crime, the untrained eye is not trained to say that only the person who gets electrocuted because the judicial system screwed up is an innocent man. The untrained eye will look around and see that there are 10 or 20 or 30,000 Americans every year who are innocent who get murdered. And to the untrained eye, that is the killing of innocent people. When a jury lets a repeat criminal go, or some lawyer lets him go again and again and again, they are, in fact, killing innocent people. But somehow, the idea that killing somebody in the electric chair is different from having somebody murdered on the street are two entirely different things. Well, I have an untrained eye. I know that if you really punish people and get those people off the street, you're going to have a lot of injustice. Otherwise, you have to presume that the legal system is flawless. And I think any lawyer or anybody else, any policeman, would get a good laugh out of that idea. On the one hand, he would get a good laugh out of it if you said that. On the other hand, he still is going by the assumption, that ridiculous assumption, that the law has to be perfect. The law is not perfect. Nothing is perfect. What we have to do is balance the people getting hurt and killed who are innocent on the street with the people who get hurt or killed who are innocent under the law. Nobody is more afraid of the law getting out of hand than I am. But this thing needs an untrained eye. The legal system, the constitutional system. All right, let's go into another example here. We, the people of the United States of America, and our posterity. Now, if you will look at this piece of paper we call the United States Constitution, the only authority for that Constitution, the only power, the only source of their power, is we, the people of the United States of America, and our posterity. Now that, today, would be considered a straight National Socialist Ku Klux Klan position. We, the people of the United States, and our posterity? The courts have ruled that any illegal alien has all constitutional rights. This piece of paper they ignore starts off by saying, we the people of the United States, the American, our posterity do. The only reason immigrants could be allowed in at all and to become citizens is because they benefited ourselves and our posterity. All those hardworking Germans and Irishmen and Italians and so forth, the ones who came over here when we needed immigrants, they became Americans because they did us good. It had nothing to do with their right to be here. It had to do with the fact that they were doing us good, and our posterity, ourselves and our posterity. And here's a little historical note that will strike the untrained eye as unimportant, but it's very important. A lot of people say, well, when the Constitution was ratified, there were lots of immigrants here. Now, what's absolutely astounding to me is that the white population of the United States, the one that was adopting this Constitution, in 1789, 1776, they had the lowest percentage of foreign-born people in America that we have ever had before or since. And they said, we, the people of the United States of America, and our posterity, they were specifically referring to people who were born here, their fathers were born here, their grandfathers were born here. Now, the reason for this is a simple matter of arithmetic. There were huge immigrations to America in the 16th century. There was Jamestown, there was Massachusetts, and then there was wave after wave of people, the Huguenots and so forth, coming over into America, and the last big wave was about 1710. After that, immigration was very, very low. Now, how did our population increase? Well, I don't want to get too graphic, but it's called a natural increase. They had huge families. They had plenty of room. They had healthy places to live. Some of those families, 10 children was not unusual. So they were not immigrants. Now, you know, anywhere in the 1700s sounds the same to us today. But if somebody came over in 1710 and his children, by the time the Constitution was ratified, 79 years later, the people doing it, ratifying it, had been born here. Their fathers had been born here. Their grandfathers had been born here. Their great-grandfathers had been born here. And remember, when I say 1710, that was the last big immigration. And my family, on both sides, like, and this is true of practically all white Southerners, or all Southerners, actually, black people were here together. So the population, all of us, have been here over 300 years. So when they said, we the people of the United States of America, they were talking, and our posterity, they were talking about the largest percentage of non-immigrants we've ever had in our history. Now, if you look at those facts, they really turn things around, because we always assume that since a bunch of people came over in the 17th century, then they must have still been coming over in the 18th century. No. The reason, and this gets around to, again, the reason the American Revolution started had nothing to do with tea taxes or whatever it is that they always argue about, whether Britain had the right to tax America and all that. It happened because it was time. There were two different countries, and the Americans were Americans. Benjamin Franklin had a problem in London because in the middle of an argument, he was representing the American interests of several colonies in England about 1770. And someone said, some Briton got up and said, this man is not an Englishman, this man is an American. And Franklin said that he was completely flustered. He was very seldom flustered. He was very flustered because he suddenly realized the man was right. He, his father, his grandfather, they'd all been born in America, and he was an old man. So, and he was an American. He was not an Englishman. So what happens when two different nations develop and one of them has the other one in the colony, the new country decides it wants its independence, and it doesn't matter about tea taxes or any of that stuff, Boston Massacre, any of that. This was going to happen. So when we're talking about Americans, and the American Constitution, the people who adopted it, we're talking about a separate people who had pulled out, they had seceded. Now, a lot of people like to quote the Declaration of Independence instead of the Constitution. That's what Lincoln did, all men are created equal, so forth and so on. The Declaration of Independence really had nothing to do with us. It was a propaganda document, and it was written in the middle of a war. Very few documents written in the middle of a war addressed all other people, including potential allies. You're not going to find a whole lot of documents written like that that are objective or actually mean what the people are saying. There was nobody in the who adopted the Declaration of Independence who thought that all men were created equal. That was a nutty idea. Still is. We all know that. Again, the untrained eye doesn't say, well, but if that and the other. It was a stupid idea that they got because they were trying to get the support of the French liberals, and they eventually did. They were appealing to the French liberal opinion, and they eventually did manage to get France in on the war. So the only statement when that was when we were appealing for foreign help, when they said something as silly as all men are created equal. The Constitution is a very business-like document. It was written over here by us without a war, and it stated that this Constitution is for us, we the people of the United States and of America and our posterity. And that's what they said, and that's exactly what they meant. We the people of the United States. And so that needs to be quoted a lot, because it is both the purpose of America, as stated, the only purpose of America. It was also the only authority in America. Now that is a constitution. If you turn the Constitution over to appointed officials or anyone else to quote interpret unquote, that is a dictatorship. Now, I hope, it would seem that anybody can understand that, but we can't understand that because we've got these trained eyes that don't look at things like that. Straight facts. I don't think I have a whole lot to say about the Constitution, except that a living Constitution is a dictatorship. And let me just look over here at Stormfront and see if anybody... good. Yeah, Northwest Lady is saying it's a constitution, a living constitution equals a dictatorship. If I get that across, I think that will be more than worth any 20 programs I could have done. So, let's see if anybody else has said anything here. Freezundle now. These are some interesting articles you have been writing, Bob. I'm going to have to check your site more often. Thank you, Freezundle. You put down the link, WhitakerOnline.org, not .com. And I certainly would appreciate you people looking at it. And my blog, I think, is really more every day, and it's more interesting. Now, James Edwards, who is a 24-year-old ball of fire in Memphis. He, and a man who's on our side, but he keeps his FCC license. He has a regular radio station and streaming video. You can listen to him every day, and I'm trying to remember. I think it's 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, but if I lied like a dog, I will correct it on Stormfront. But he's a brilliant young man. And he's a pro. He runs his own show. And he has told me that any time I want him as a guest, he will be glad to help out, for which I am grateful. Now, the reason I do not have James on here at the present time is because when you have guests, it takes another piece of equipment, more training, until I learn not to step on my headset and how to do the basic stuff. I am not going to take any more pieces of equipment. David says I should have an intro. An intro requires, it's very simple, and you just push this button and so forth after you've recorded it. Well, I have another young, great professional in the radio industry who has offered to do, in fact, he did the intros for Dr. Pierce for his radio program. And I am just can't wait to have him do an intro for me. But I'm not about to touch that thing until I've learned to do this. And obviously I haven't, since this program is over an hour late. So the other thing, and the clincher, is that when I said, talked about guests, James Kelso said unto me, he said, "You can do it easily, Bob. It's very simple." Now that, those words from James Kelso make my blood run cold. So, until I learn to get my computer in basic shape and all that, I won't be able to have the guests on here that I would really love to. And we're going to have to decide Saturday whether we're going to do the show or not. And if we did, look at the people I'll be surrounded by in New Orleans. I'm getting in there, I think, around noon, probably. And all of these great people are going to be surrounding me. And I would love to have, a 12-hour show with those guests. 20 hours. Maybe if Kelso is right there, maybe we can do it. I don't know. We probably won't have time. But the reason I do all the talking and I don't have an intro is quite simply because it would be stupid for me to try to handle new equipment when I can't handle the equipment I've got. And it'll all take its own time. Something I mentioned in Stormfront was that these things, that if you look at history and you see something that happened in 1920, and then you notice that in 1923 it all came out right. If you're reading history, it's like those people who think America was full of immigrants in 1789, because to them 1789 and 1715 are the same years. Well, for the people living in those years, they were not the same years. They were generations. And if you are trying desperately to do something in 1920, you have a lot of time to get terribly discouraged by 1923. That was three long years to them. To us, it's just one piece of history to another. You have to read history with the idea in mind that those were real years. And so when we're sitting here, last year, the New Orleans conference had 300, I think. This year we're going to have 500. Stormfront is growing like crazy. I'm sitting around banging on this radio, on this whole system, the same way that people were terribly frustrated with the radios in 1919 and the way that the early TV went. It was really primitive. You wouldn't even recognize it. But what I'm saying is, this 1 year, these 2 years, these mistakes, all that stuff, just look across them. It's going to be a long fight, and what I see is things going great. I think that I've probably used up the hour. Now I'm going to take one more look That's on front. Let's see. Here is Albion MP. Bob in ancient Rome, in times of crisis, the Romans deemed it necessary to have a dictatorship, albeit for limited periods of time. Yeah, that's where the word dictatorship came from. Not only that, in the American Revolution, a gentleman named Rutledge was made, quote, dictator of South Carolina, unquote. That is why it was that's why the Constitution, or why the Declaration of Independence was finally signed on July 4th instead of July 2nd, because the South Carolina delegates could not decide whether they had to have the go-ahead from Rutledge way back in South Carolina to sign it, so they delayed it 2 days. Back in the old days, and actually it's before the Roman Empire too, a dictator was not called an interpreter. It was an emergency, and therefore it was an emergency measure for a limited time. Certainly not as long as the story of Cincinnatus, who won all the battles and so forth, and then went back to his farm in Rome. Certainly have dictatorships, and that means quite simply, a man dictates. At the time, it didn't have the same implication we have, because today a dictatorship is permanent, so it's not at all the same thing. In a state of emergency, they would have their dictatorships. And they called them dictatorships, because one man needs to dictate. But today, we call it, in Russia and with Marx, they called it the dictatorship of the proletariat, true democracy. In the United States, we call it a living constitution. It all comes down to the same thing. It's a dictatorship. It's just that, unlike the ancients, we don't use the word. Well, that takes care of the nice people who were willing to actually say something to me. Go to chronoline.org is my website. I have a blog that I'd like you to read. Now, what I'd really like you to look at is readbob.com. Readbob.com. People always come up to me and saying, now how can I get a hold of your book? At the first conference, I actually pasted it on the wall. Readbob.com. readbob.com. People at the conference walked up to me and said, how can I get a hold of your book? I don't know how I can make it a whole lot clearer, because I'm from Pontiac, South Carolina. Even I can remember readbob.com. And I sure would like some support on my book. I'd like to take a look at my strategy, so I'll talk about later in later programs about fighting the establishment, how we can really fight it. Very simple. Again, what I say is simple, but it's not easy. So I think I've used up my hour, and since I don't have an intro or an extra, I'll just say, I hope I see you next Saturday. It depends on what, if we get all mixed up with the New Orleans conference, it may not be possible, but you can probably survive without it for a week.